People like to pull for underdogs. We like it when a number 16 seed takes down a number 1 seed in an NCAA basketball tournament. But you know what I mean. But think on a much grander scale of like the American Revolution, when a ragtag army of colonists stood against the well-equipped redcoats and won their independence from England. Or recall the miracle on ice at the 1980 Winter Olympics when an unknown group of American hockey players whipped the undefeatable Soviets at their own game. These and countless other stories of unexpected heroes rising to the occasion line the shelves of bookstores, and they draw crowds to movie theaters. The underdogs, with the odds stacked against them, somehow pull off an astonishing victory. And this moving theme undergirds the plots of many historic blockbusters like Star Wars and The Karate Kid, and Diana and I watched the first episode of the Rocky series the other night with Sylvester Stallone. Yes, we like underdog stories. That is, as long as we're not the underdog. That mentality tends to shift when we're the ones who are outnumbered or outweighed or outmaneuvered. More often than not, instead of standing tall, we slink away. Instead of drumming up optimism, we slip into pessimism. Instead of charging the hill, we retreat in an attitude of defeat. Left all alone, we begin to feel, well, reluctant, overwhelmed, intimidated. We prepare for loss long before we've even entered the fray. Strange how that works, isn't it? We love the stories of other underdogs taking on the big dog. But all too often we believe those stunning victories could never happen to us. And God preserved an account in Scripture that sheds light on this classic underdog dilemma. Though true, this story has become a metaphor for any against all odds confrontation between a little guy and a giant. How often have we heard people talk about a David and Goliath moment and how deeply they long for David to win? Yet if observers stood on that ancient battlefield, they would, and if they were taking bets on the outcome, nobody would have placed a wager on David. Writing in Clinging to Hope, Chuck Swindoll relates, "I'll never forget the day I met a real giant. Years ago, Cynthia and I were vacationing with several family members on the small island of Kauai, Hawaii. I got up one morning for an early jog along the beach, opened the door to my hotel room, and stepped out into the hallway. And to my absolute shock, standing before me was a 7'2" real-life giant. The true shock was I had just watched that giant win the NBA championship with the L.A. Lakers just a couple weeks earlier. And there he stood, staring down at me, basketball legend Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The man not only had a giant reputation, but his looming presence made me feel like I had shrunk several inches. When my heart started beating again, I realized he wasn't at all the mythical giant that I had expected. You see, he had misplaced the key to his room, just like every average Joe does a dozen times while vacationing. And there he was, roaming the hallway to see if his wife had dropped it somewhere along the way. Believe it or not, it turned out to be that his key was on the floor in our room, just inside the entrance, and his wife had slid it under the door, thinking our room was theirs. Well, so much for giants. And after a few friendly words, we went our separate ways, and I still chuckle when I remember that encounter. And wouldn't it be great if we could just laugh off all of life's giants? And while we can avoid some imposing confrontations, we can't dodge them all. Often running's not an option. This is especially true true when giants threaten our families. And with so much at stake, we have to turn and take a stand. So let's return. It's one of the most familiar stories in the Bible, so well known that people who haven't even cracked open Holy Scripture have heard about it. And though this story deals with a real giant named Goliath and a real underdog named David, it does illustrate a vital lesson about facing the inevitable giants in our lives. And that lesson is summed up in 1 John 4:4. You belong to God, my dear children. You have already won a victory over those people because the spirit who lives in you is greater than the spirit who lives in the world. We all deal with giants from time to time, and even though none of them are 9 feet tall and clad in armor and roaming the streets of our neighborhood, that doesn't make them any less real. Most of the time, they're not even people, but terrifying situation or exasperating circumstances or frightening challenges, threatening experience. And though they don't have a proper name, they are giants nevertheless. Are you and I ready to face the intimidating giants in our life? Have we had enough of caving in to their invasive intimidation? If so, let's look this morning at an all too familiar tale. The story of David and Goliath in 1 Samuel 17 is 58 verses packed with tension and drama, suspense, action, twists, even a touch of humor. No wonder people young and old have been drawn to it over the centuries. That story is very familiar to us, and maybe too familiar. Sometimes we miss important details in its overtelling. Like Diana and I, like me, we perhaps first heard the story from our mom relating it to us, or heard about it in a Sunday school lesson, or in a children's Bible storybook, even seen it in a cartoon. However, we rarely explore some of the nooks and crannies in its biblical account. When we do, we notice some interesting and important details that might cast the story in a little different light. But let's start with the chapter just before 1 Samuel 16, before Goliath shows up. An important principle puts the whole encounter in perspective. As the prophet Samuel zeroes in on the Lord's choice to replace King Saul, God leads him to the household of Jesse in Bethlehem. And after taking one look at Jesse's son Eliab, Samuel thinks, "Surely this is the Lord's anointed," verse 6. Apparently, Eliab was quite a good-looking character, tall, strong, handsome. God quickly turns Samuel's attention away from Eliab with these great words in verse 7 of chapter 16. "Don't judge by his appearance or height, for I have rejected him. The Lord doesn't see things the way you see them. People judge by outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart." We should never forget that. That principle holds true for all people at all times. We can easily be impressed with outside appearances, intimidated by strength, or overwhelmed by the person's position or rank or fame or fortune or title. We forget that none of these features matter to God. He doesn't judge people by what's on the outside, but by the authenticity of their lives, the condition of their hearts. And that's why God chooses David from among Jesse's son. That kid is so far off Jesse's radar as a candidate for kingship that he doesn't even bother to present him past the prophet with the rest of his sons. And when God rejects every one of Jesse's boys, Samuel asks if they are all he has. And Jesse replies, well, they're still the youngest, but he's out in the fields watching the sheep and goats. Classic underdog. And as soon as David arrives, God speaks. Verse 12, this is the one, anoint him. Chuck Swindoll comments, I can imagine David's older brothers turning a little green with envy as that ceremonial oil runs down David's neck and back, making and marking him as the future king of Israel. Even his own father wouldn't have guessed it, and perhaps David himself has only the faintest idea what's going on. But God has a plan for this underdog, and his opinion is all that matters. In 1 Samuel 17, a little time has passed since David's anointing. He's back in the fields, watching over his father's sheep and goats. Saul is the king. He's flip-flopping his way through politics and power, wrestling his own demons, which threaten to undo him. Meanwhile, the Valley of Elah has erupted into conflict, and the Philistines assemble on one side of the ravine, and the army of Israel encamps on the other. Enter the massive giant of Gath, Goliath. Let's let Max Licato describe the scene. Goliath stares down from the hillside. Only disbelief keeps him from laughing. He and his Philistines have rendered their half of the valley into a forest of spears, a growling, bloodthirsty gang of hoodlums, boasting the do-rags, B.O., barbed wire tattoos. Goliath towers above them all, 9 feet 9 in his stocking feet, wearing 125 pounds of armor, snarling like the main contender at the Worldwide Wrestling Federation Championship night. He has a size 20 collar, massive helmet, 56-inch belt. His biceps just burst. Thick thigh muscles ripple. Boasts belch through his out the canyon. Verse 17:10, this day I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man and let us fight each other. Who will go mano a mano, Camingo? Give me your best shot. No Hebrew volunteers. Until today. Until David. David just showed up this morning. He clocked out of sheep watching to deliver bread and cheese to his brothers on the front lines. And that's where David hears Goliath defying God. And that's when David makes his decision. Then he takes his staff in his hand and he chooses for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, puts them in a shepherd's bag in a pouch that he has, and his sling in his hand, and he draws near to the Philistine. Goliath scoffs at the kid, nicknames him Twiggy. Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? Skinny, scrawny David. Bulky, brutish Goliath. A toothpick versus a tornado. Mini bike attacking the 18-wheeler. The toy poodle taking on the Rottweiler. What odds do you give David against his giant? Better odds, perhaps, than you give yourself against yours. Your Goliath doesn't carry a sword or a shield. Perhaps he brandishes blades of unemployment or abandonment or sexual abuse or depression. Your giant doesn't parade up and down the hills of Elah. He prances through your office or your bedroom or your classroom. He brings bills you can't pay, grades you can't make, people you can't please, perhaps whiskey you can't resist, pornography you can't refuse, a career you can't escape, a past you can't shake, a future you can't face. You know well the roar of your Goliath. David faced one who foghorned his challenges morning and evening. Verse 16, for 40 days, twice a day, morning and evening, the Philistine giant strutted in front of the Israeli army. Perhaps yours does the same. First thought in the morning, last thought in the evening. A Goliath who dominates your day and infiltrates your joy. How long has he stalked you? Goliath's family was an ancient foe of the Israelites. Joshua drove them out of the promised land 300 years earlier. He destroyed everyone except the residents of Gaza and Gath and Ashdod. Gath bred giants like Yosemite breeds sequoias. Guess where Goliath was raised? You see that big G on his letter jacket? Gath High School. His ancestors were to the Hebrews what pirates were to Her Majesty's Navy. Saul's soldier saw Goliath and mumbled, "Not again, my dad fought his dad, my granddad fought his granddad." Perhaps you've grown similar words. I'm becoming a workaholic, just like my father. Addiction streaks through our family like our family tree, like oak wilt. My mom couldn't keep a friend either. Is it ever going to stop? There's Goliath, the long-standing bully of the valley. Tougher than a $2 steak, more snarls than twin Dobermans. He awaits you in the morning, torments you at night. He stalked your ancestors, now looks over you and looms over. He blocks the sun and leaves you standing in the shadow of doubt. Verse 11, when Saul and his troops heard the Philistines' challenge, they were terrified and lost all hope. Max adds, what am I telling you? You know Goliath. You recognize his walk. You can wince at his talk. You've seen your Godzilla. The question is he all you see? You know his voice, but it is all you hear. David saw, but he heard more. Listen to the very first words he spoke, not just in the battle, but in the Bible. David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" David shows up discussing God. The soldiers mention nothing about him. The brothers never spoke his name. But David takes one step onto the stage and raises the subject of a living God. He does the same with King Saul. No cliches or about the battle. No chit-chat, questions about the odds. Just a God-birthed announcement in verse 37. The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And he continues the theme with Goliath. When the giant mocks David, the shepherd boy replies in verses 45 to 47, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will hand you over to me, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. Today I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air and the beasts of the earth, and the whole world will know there is a God in Israel. All those gathered here will know that it is not by sword or spear that the Lord saves. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give all of you into my hands. No one else discusses God. David discusses no one else but God. A subplot appears in the story, more so than David versus Goliath. This is God focus versus giant focus. David sees what others don't, and he refuses to see what others do. All eyes except David's fall on the brutal, hate-breathing Hulk. All compasses except David's are set on the pole star of the Philistine. All journals but David's describe day after day in the land of the Neanderthal. The people know his taunts, his demands, his sighs, his strut. They've all majored in Goliath. But David majors in God. He sees the giant, mind you. He just sees God more so. Look carefully at David's battle cry in verse 45. You come to me with a sword, with a spear, with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel. Notice that plural noun, the armies of Israel. The common observer just sees only one army of Israel, not David. He sees the allies on D-Day and platoons of angels, infantries of saints, the weapons of the wind, the forces of the earth. God could pellet the enemy with hail as he did for Moses. He could collapse walls as he did for Joshua, stir thunder as he did for Samuel. David sees the armies of God. And because he does, David hurries and rushes in toward the army to meet the Philistine. David's brothers, cover their eyes out of embarrassment and fear. Saul just sighs as he sees the young Hebrew charge into what should be certain death. Goliath throws back his head in laughter, just enough to shift his helmet and expose a square inch of forehead flesh. David spots the target, seizes the moment. The sound of the swirling sling is the only sound in the valley. The storm torpedoes through the air and into the skull, and Goliath's eyes cross and legs buckle. He crumples to the ground and dies. And David runs over and yanks Goliath's sword from its sheath. He shish kebabs the Philistine and cuts off his head. Max Lucado pens, you might say that David knew how to get ahead of his giant. When was the last time you did the same? How long since you ran toward your challenge? We tend to retreat. Duck behind a desk of work, crawl into a nightclub of distraction, a bed of forbidden love. For a moment a day or a year, we feel safe and insulated and anesthetized. But then the work runs out, the liquor wears off, the lover leaves, and we hear Goliath again, booming bombastic. Try a different tack. Rush your giant with a God-saturated soul. Giant of addiction, you are not entering my home. Giant of depression, it may take a lifetime, but you won't conquer me. Giant of bigotry and child abuse and insecurity and rejection, you're going down. How long since you loaded your sling and took a swing at your giant? Chuck Swindoll, what are you going to do when the giants of life attack? Let me speak from my lifetime of experience. You can't beat walking by faith. You can't beat stepping into the battle in the strength of the Lord. David's your model. God called him a man after my own heart. He gave the appellation to no one else, not Abraham or Moses or Joseph. He called Paul an apostle and John the beloved, but neither was tagged a man after God's own heart. Max again. One might read David's story and wonder what God saw in him. This fellow, he fell as often as he stood. He stumbled as often as he conquered. He stared down Goliath, yet he ogled at Bathsheba. He defied God markers in the valley, and yet joined them in the wilderness. An Eagle Scout one day, chumming with the mafia the next. Raging David, weeping David, bloodthirsty, God hungry, 8 wives, 1 God. A man after God's own heart. That God saw him as such gives hope to us all. Dave's life had little to offer the unstained saint. Straight A soul find David's story, well, disappointing. The rest of it find it reassuring. We ride the same roller coaster. We alternate between swan dives and belly flops, souffles and burnt toast. In David's good moments, no one was better. In his bad moments, could one be worse? The heart that God loved was a checkered one. We need David's story, for giants lurk in our neighborhoods. Giants. We must face them, but we need not face them alone. Focus first and most, as David did, on God. The times David did, giants fell. The days he didn't, David fell. Some note the absence of miracles in David's story. No Red Sea opening, no chariots flaming, no dead Lazaruses walking, no miracles. But there is one. David is one. A rough-edged walking wonder of God. David, neon lights this truth. Focus on giants, you stumble. Focus on God, your giants tumble. The God who made a miracle out of David stands ready to make one out of you. The same God who helped him will help you. You can count on it. Selah.